The content here is for informational purposes only, should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security, and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any A16Z fund. For more details, please see a16z.com/disclosures.
Welcome to the A16Z podcast. Today we have one of our hallway-style conversations between Benedict Evans and Steven Snofsky, and they'll be discussing big companies and their platforms. Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. What makes them work, how their tactics and strategies differ, and how they've adapted to change over time.
Good afternoon. This is Steven Snofsky and Benedict here. We were having this hallway conversation about what is it that makes a big company unique and interesting to think about from an org perspective. The thing about big companies that we wanted to start with is, of course, is that they work. Like, they're not dysfunctional as a very nature. And from the outside, everything might look mixed up or people might be complaining, but for the most part, like, they got to be big.
Yeah. So the thing I thought was specifically interesting, just kind of looking at the tech world today, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, as being together about 10 times the size in terms of the number of people that they were 10, 12 years ago. And how is it that they've ballooned in this size and have 10 times the people that they used to have not that long ago, and yet continue, for all intents and purposes, to work well, continue to create great products, more or less? How do those companies run? And when you talk to people there, what you realize very quickly is that they're actually run in radically different ways.
From each other.
From each other.
And inside. Like, even across them inside, they're quite different.
Yeah. And that's sort of partly related to the product that they have. But it's also just kind of reflects kind of complete difference in philosophy. The interesting way to think about it is that obviously we think of Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon as being platform companies. But when we say that, we're really thinking about the software and the network effect and the chips and so on. Actually, just as important is the platform of the people and the organization of those people and how that can be deployed.
Right. And of course, very old saying in technology, and a lot of studies have gone into this notion that when companies make products, the product is a reflection of the organization. And, you know, the flip side is, ooh, don't ship the org chart. But the truth is that the org is as much a product of a company as the product. We should caveat this whole thing by saying that, you know, whatever we say about any of the given companies is both right and probably runs counter to any one person's experience. For me, the other thing that's super important is that even in the most well-run large organization, it's actually never like one company. It's not homogeneous. It's not self-consistent. It's not a monolithic thing, no matter what people say from the outside. It's fun to point to, and it's fun to try to draw an arrow from a product to that org chart or assign causal relationships, but it's not really, really like that.
Yeah, there's always that complexity. You have to think about like the internal dynamics of kind of chaos and entropy and, you know, personal politics and so on, as well as like the overall strategy. But there's also like another important distinction that each of these companies tend to have kind of a fundamental strategy, but they also have a bunch of things going on inside that are more like tactics that support that strategy. And the fun thing about looking at specifically Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon is that generally the stuff that, the stuff that's a strategy for one company is tactics for other companies. So, you know, Apple's strategy is to have an operating system. And for Google, that's just a tactic. Google's strategy is to do search. For Apple, that's just a tactic. And
right.
So on.
And, you know, and Amazon has search and uses Google Ads, but views it as a tactic to implement their store. What's tricky from the outside is that there are people who pay really close attention to only one element or one part of that strategy. And sometimes they think a big company is missing the boat because they're not all in on doing battle in that space, you know, like Google and hardware. Like, people are like, are they going to do it, not do it? And it's a tactic for them. It's not a core part of the strategy. And that doesn't mean that they're making a mistake doing it. It means that they've made a decision about how they want to go about doing it.
Well, the classic thing that drives me crazy, people talking about Apple, thinking that the App Store is like a primary revenue driver for Apple, when the whole purpose of the App Store is to drive sales of a $700 iPhone every 2 years at a 50% gross margin.
Right. Well, if you think about like just your iCloud subscription, like if Apple really, really thought that that was the most important thing, would they bury it like five levels deep in the UI to upgrade? No, if it was the most important thing, every time you remove your phone from sleep, it would warn you that you need more storage, the way that using a product that storage is their primary business might.
But there's also within that, actually, you can see the kind of, there is a tactic and the strategy, because the grand strategy might say, well, why are you charging at all? You should give it away for free. But then the tactic, you say, well, we can make some money doing
this. Quite often, the things you read about that say companies are messed up come from people who aren't happy with what's going on. They might not agree with the strategy. They might more likely just not agree with the implementation choices, the choice of product, the choice of code, the org choice, the leadership choice. And that causes them to sort of tell a story.
And you also get kind of, it's the opposite of survivor bias. You get the post facto description of why it was obvious that this company was going to fail, or why it was obvious this product was going to fail. And actually, if you go and look at now the descriptions of the genesis of the iPhone now, like if the iPhone had failed, you could tell all of the same stories to show why it wasn't going to work.
Right. Well, you would have said like, oh my God, they had the working thing with the iPod group. They didn't pick the iPod code. They really should have gone with the thing that was already in market and already working. And they made some big science project bet on porting this thing.
And of course, Apple was going to collapse. Just look at the political conflicts that they had 5 years later. Well, obviously that meant that the iPhone was going to go down in flames. Well, you know, you can always come up with these things in hindsight.
The flip side is when you read this glowing positive story about how a company worked, the negative stories make it look like a company is Fight Club or like Twister in how it works. And then the positives make it look like this orchestrated ballet or symphony when, you know, oh, we had a small disagreement. So we had a meeting. We resolved it by evaluating the alternatives and everybody agreed. And then we had tea and it was wonderful.
And then we wrote up the Harvard Business Review's case study.
Yes. The one other thing I would say, too, is often when people look at these things, they're like looking for the one thing that they should do when they run their company, their org. And they look to these successes, the survivor bias of big companies. And it's really important to keep in mind that you can't really take one thing that a company does and then extract from that, like, oh, this is how we're going to operate. And it's very much, I wanted to do in the gratuitous Star Trek analogy, and it's from the episode of the original series, Squire of Gothos. The episode is, as everybody knows, that the Squire of Gothos is out there and he's got some fancy radar sonar thing and he can see what Earth is like hundreds of years ago and he replicates it for the landing crew. But all of a sudden they taste some of the food and it doesn't taste right. And the reason it doesn't taste right is because his sensors don't pick up taste. So he could fake what it looks like, but he doesn't know what it really should be. And that's a lot about like, you know, Amazon is famous for 3-page memos. That doesn't mean everybody should go write 3-page memos and then you'll be a $500 billion company. It doesn't quite
Apple
follow.
Apple is famous for secrecy. It doesn't mean you don't tell anybody anything and then you'll become the world's biggest consumer electronics company.
Exactly. So what are some of the things that come to your head when you want to try to understand what's really important to a company? For me, like you first want to know, like, are they focused on APIs or, you know, like features and experiences?
Yeah, I mean, are they creating? I mean, this is the Marcus Aurelius thing. What is it? What is the thing in itself? And again, you can kind of get misled by this. So, you know, people look at Amazon, at Facebook and Google and think they're advertising companies. And they're not. Google is a company that's around handling vast amounts of data. And everything that Google then does is sort of an expression of that. Facebook is a product around connecting people and everything that it does has to be around that. Whereas Apple is a company around creating a very specific kind of hardware company that has like a 5-year product cycle between like 3 years of planning and then 2 years of it being in the market. And so they need an organization structure that can handle that and deliver that kind of thing, which is very different from Facebook needing to be able to decide, well, this thing isn't working, so we'll kill it and replace it with something else tomorrow. And then Amazon, I think perhaps is kind of most unique of these four companies in that it's this sort of radically decentralized, almost atomized organization. That you have this underlying platform of logistics and e-commerce, but then everything else is like the one pizza team or the two pizza team. So it's like makeup in France is 3 people. Shoes in Germany is 2 people.
Yeah, in fact, geography is an interesting overlay on how they even approach that. And for me, like those descriptions are perfectly encapsulate this notion that the way that you're a $500 billion company is you have like a monstrous platform. And that used to be a really big word that Alfred Sloan created in thinking about Detroit and cars in the 50s and
the
60s.
That you have a car platform.
You have a car platform, and then you put different bodies on it and brands.
Yeah, and you make an Oldsmobile and a Buick out of the same platform.
You look at that platform, and then you start to ask yourself questions like, you know, how do they decide? Are they focused on revenue? Are they focused on usage? Are they focused on enterprise customers or consumer companies? You know, there's a lot that goes into using the platform that's based on internal notions. Like, are there requirements that you do things with the platform internally or not? And that's what drives the organization itself. You know, like Google is well known, and we'll start with Google. Like, they're well known for having this incredible environment that when you're an engineer at Google, you show up and you like in a heartbeat can tap in to like this massive build process, this massive experimentation platform, and all of this data.
Google is a platform for handling hard problems at scale, for handling massive amounts of data at scale. And it's relatively agnostic about exactly what those problems are. It's quite relaxed about having like two or three different teams trying to solve that problem in different parts of the company. And then things within that then become tactics. The real point is the data and the solving that problem for customers.
Right. And fundamentally, from a platform of people point of view, Google, and this is where this subtlety and nuance really needs to be figured into this conversation, which is Google is not one organization. It's one type of culture around billions of scale in the billions, super hard problems. But they really are like an enterprise company focused on search. You know, like that's built in there, and they have a product cycle that looks like an enterprise company, a sales force that looks like an enterprise company. They treat changes to the product the way that an enterprise company would treat changes to the product.
Yeah, and I mentioned the fallacy earlier of people thinking that revenue from the App Store matters to Apple.
Right.
There's an equivalent one, which is people saying, oh, Google doesn't make any money from Android. Well, this is not the point. That's not in any sense why Android exists.
Right.
It's a tactic to support those underlying platforms.
And the companies will ebb and flow from a management perspective about how much experimentation in that regard they can financially support, or maybe they need more resources in another place. And the fact that those connections are loose actually make those decisions easier. Because they don't, you know, so it's a smart management strategy to not goal everybody on everything. Because the minute you do that, then your linear equations are too hard to move people around. Because having flexibility is both good for the employees and good for the company. And it is how you end up with like something that looks strategically not so smart, like multiple messaging clients. But from a tactic point of view, that's not a big deal. That's like having different marketing messages in France versus Germany. Like, it's okay.
I think that's an interesting way on messaging to go into Facebook.
So yeah,
there's quite a lot of similarity between Facebook and Google, and very obviously in their cloud companies. But also that they have, on the one hand, the enterprise sales force, of course, which was built by the same person.
Yeah. So it's, again, an enterprise company, and the Facebook core product kind of changes at the velocity of an enterprise product more than you think of as like a fast-paced, like constantly changing thing.
So you've got the enterprise sales force, and then you've got the data thing with a much narrower focus.
Right.
It's not, you know, understand everything in any way to anybody. It's work out the right ways of connecting people. And I've always kind of thought about Facebook as surfing user behavior, that it's very, very good at thinking about how people's behavior are changing and changing the product. And so Facebook has been like five different things over the length of its life. You know, there was a time when it was all about filling in information on your home profile. You know, who goes to a Facebook profile now?
Right.
And that's, in a sense, been directed by Facebook.
Right.
And so the willingness, kind of the key there is to sense which way the wind is blowing and to move where users are going and where user behavior is going on top of that.
Like, remember when all of a sudden photos became really important, and the idea was get people to post photos, and then all of a sudden there was this kind of a like, oh, wait, in order to get something to surface in the feed, it had to have a photo. And then they decided video was important. But all within this same sort of very deliberate, very sort of mature view of pace of change and things, you know, counter to this notion of like that was the very early origin of move fast and break things. And then the other part, of course, from an organizational perspective, is that it very much like a very large scale mature company, they have other product lines, you know, between WhatsApp and Instagram, Oculus, and so on, that are run as very distinct entities. And they don't overlay some grand strategy about what's going to go where and who's going to do what when and tie all the pieces together.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fruitful analogy, I think, in looking at Facebook as being a bit like Microsoft Office. There's stories in Facebook and there's stories in Instagram and there's stories in WhatsApp, just as like there was a charting tool in tables, because of course you should be able to do tables in a slide. And of course you should be able to do tables in Word. Should there be exactly the same table tool? Well, maybe at some point we'll get around to integrating them. Is that our absolutely highest priority right now? No, not really. The key point is that application follows the needs of its users and shapes what that particular product needs to be.
These are these things that if you overthink from the outside and overanalyze, you get all bent out of shape, that this doesn't all fit together in some neat puzzle because the products aren't clear. When do I use WhatsApp versus this?
And it's like, who cares?
But it doesn't, who cares? And like, no person is making that choice. They're just using the one that they're going to use because of whatever network effect or whatever reason. And that's where, like, it's fascinating for me, because Facebook is, the usage model is aimed at consumers. They're not put under the sort of the industry analyst enterprise Gartner report over, like, is this a charting tool or a numbers tool or a presentation graphics tool? And then it can't have overlap and it needs to all fit strategically together. And that shows a real strength. I think it's a huge organizational strength and maturity that they not just permit that to happen, but their org is designed around making that an acceptable way to move forward.
Mm. It's that, it's the same thing. It's like what's Mark Andreessen's phrase is, you know, strong opinions look weakly held.
Right.
Back to what we were saying earlier about Google, that, okay, there is a core capability that we're going to do, but we're kind of relaxed about having four different groups working on that in different ways in different places. Because, you know, each of those will solve things in a different way. And it doesn't kind of matter that it doesn't all kind of tie up neatly in an org chart.
The external view is that it needs to all fit together. And the internal view, it just isn't a problem.
That's a tactic. That's not the strategy.
Right. And which is actually interesting, because the internal-external view definitely leads us to Apple, where for me, Apple has this very clear mode of working, which is they have a strategy and they have a plan and they're an execution monster. And they're just not going to share it with anybody. And that just drives people crazy.
Yes.
Like this notion of how can you know all of this and then just not have billboards on 101 telling us what the iPhone 11 is going to look like?
Yes, which of course they know now, more or less.
And what's interesting to me about it is that it gets back to our earlier conversations on Twitter about leaks and stuff. People think that Apple is like, it's oppressive from the outside. It must be oppressive and you can't leak. And it's like, no, actually, if you talk to anybody about Apple, they're pretty chill about the whole thing because they actually know they have a plan and they know they have a strategy. And so they're not worried that it's all wrong. They have confidence in their management structure. The management structure is appropriately translucent, I like to say, throughout the org. And so people don't run around like leaking their things. And, you know, and when there is a leak, often the people feel really, really bad as a team. They don't look to blame the person. The outside world wants to find the culprit. But internally, they're quite mature about the whole thing. But there's
a deterministic element here, which is, you know, Google and Facebook are producing stuff that gets deployed every hour. So that creates a certain kind of structure. Apple is producing something, you know, the iPhone 8, for the sake of arg, whatever the name is going to be announced in a month or so. But that was being planned 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's been baked in for basically at least a year now. They pretty much decided what the next one is going to be, and they're well into the one after that. And so that produces a requirement for an organization that looks very different, that's much more kind of systematic and methodical and structured, because, you know, stuff has to be decided now in 50 million of them are going to roll off in a ship in a year and a half.
Yeah. And also we should point out that like there are projects going on at Google or Facebook to reinvent big parts of what we see. And those are going to take years to deploy. If Google wants to replace MapReduce with some new thing, or if they are going to roll out like the new way of doing machine learning internally, they'll work on that for the same amount of time that Apple works on a phone.
Or a file system.
It's just that they're not going to release it little bits at a time, and they're not going to do press releases, you know, at every milestone.
We talked about the split inside Facebook and Google between like the enterprise sales, very crudely, the enterprise sales business and the stuff all around that supports that. And there's the enterprise sales product, and then there's the consumer product, and then there's the stuff that sits all around this kind of pushing it and supporting it. The thing at Apple is there is like the Gantt chart to produce the specific products that are going to drop in a certain period of time. But there's also the platform there of the people and the operating, both the operating system and the chip, but the software people and the chip people, and the capability to point all of those people and say, we're going to solve that thing now.
Yeah.
And so just as where Google could say, like, machine learning is a thing now, let's point that at photos and solve photos.
In a fairly short order.
Yeah, and very quickly.
It was literally less than a year, I think, that whole project lasted.
But equally, you know, Apple has taken that team and pointed it at the Echo, and said, make an Echo that's Apple-y.
Again, this is this part of a platform. So they have the platform of the people that know how to work their platform of code and product. And what Apple is able to do is the bet that they've made is that we have a platform that's made up of a set of APIs, a Unix operating system kernel, these ARM chips that have all of these sensors and capabilities. And it turns out the thing that they do uniquely is they can take that platform and then take the 80% of it that they need for a watch or a speaker or a television set or whatever. And then what's unique about how they approach it is that they take the 20% that might not be viewed as super hard or super difficult to get done. And they actually spend a massive amount of time and energy to do the whole part of what it takes to be a watch. And I think that that's an interesting contrast, say, with Android, where they also had the platform. But they had a different approach, which was like, well, that's not necessarily the hard part, and the ecosystem will round it out, and people will try different things. And so you get a different kind of product out of that. And that is what people think of as the end-to-end engineering of Apple, but it's also an org commitment that they make. Like they tell the team and they get the team to go finish the whole of the product, in it, which is a unique way of doing it.
Well, it's a specific culture, but it's also the capability.
Yeah.
That you have the chip people and you have the designers and you have, you know, right down to the stores, you have an ability to create a certain kind of product, and you can take that ability and point it at things.
Yeah.
You can point it at a watch, you can point it at a home speaker, you can point it at TV. There's stuff that you pointed out that, you know, where you kind of try and work out what it would be. And, you know, clearly the Apple right now is kind of trying to work out what it would mean to do a car.
Right. And that's what's so interesting about that is how, you know, that capability isn't universal. And so a huge part of the culture of a company is making sure that they choose the right thing to point it out. What, you know, back in the 60s when Ford had the Mustang, you know, every Detroit company had a platform of four wheels and a high performance engine to make a car like that. But GM just could not figure out how to respond to the Mustang, and they were in a panic. And so figuring out, once you have the underpinnings, it's also a huge management task. And that's the discipline that I think that Tim Cook talks about, is figuring out what to say no to, what to say yes to.
I wrote a piece a couple of years ago kind of comparing Google to the story about how a shark will bite something to see if it's a seal. And if it's not, it'll spit it out. So Google bites things to see if they fit Google. And so like they tried healthcare and it just didn't work. And they would have had to have changed what Google was too much in order to make healthcare work.
Which is super disciplined.
And they tried radio like over 10 years ago. They bought a radio advertising company and they worked out that they could not make radio work without changing what Google was. So they didn't do it. And that's exactly the same as Apple saying no to a product, because it would have to make them not Apple in order to make that work. Each of these platforms have kind of, there are places where they're extremely good at giving that kind of product. And maybe the other companies in the set might be very bad at doing that. That, you know, the stuff that Apple would be really bad at making that thing, and Google would be really bad at making that thing, and Facebook would be really bad at making that thing. And part of the strength is actually knowing that and pulling back and saying, no, we're going to stay in our canal.
And we have Amazon. What's interesting is they might not worry too much if they're really good at it or not really good. They seem to be very brave about, like, let's make phones, let's make readers, let's make speakers.
Yeah,
let's do voice recognition.
So I'd see it as sort of the structure almost kind of at a right angle to that. So I think like kind of the sort of elevator description of Amazon is that you have two fundamental platforms. You have the physical logistics platform and the e-commerce platform. You could argue now they're adding a third in the form of Prime, which is slightly different. And then everything else sits on top of that and is radically decentralized. So everything is a team. Is a team of like three people. So shoes in Germany is three people, and makeup in France is four people. And music players, well, pick a category. It's a small number of people and it's completely atomized, and everyone has internal transparency as to their metrics. And the point of that is that you can kind of scale that almost indefinitely. That if you want to add more categories, you don't need to add another direct report to Jeff Bezos. It's not a tree structure.
Right. And importantly, neither is Amazon itself. Like, and especially, in fact, search has made this such an interesting thing, because if you find everything by search, and this was the difference between Google and Yahoo, with Yahoo was a hierarchy and you had to enter Yahoo from the top and then sort of navigate it. And once you do search, you don't need the top of the internet, and Amazon doesn't need the top. Like they can sell you anything, because you're just going to have to look for it and they have to get good at doing that. And so they can really scale what they offer like fairly infinitely. And what's so fascinating about that is nothing has to be a huge success. Like they can decide to do something or not do something and work on it for a while and then decide if that's delivering the customer satisfaction that they want, or the ROI that they want, or the connection to other products that they want, and they're okay.
Yeah. And that means on the one hand that they can scale almost indefinitely by country and by into new product categories. You know, it raises the question, okay, are there product categories where that don't fit that commodity model?
Well, and that's what everybody's asking about Whole Foods and groceries, or, you know, like
the question right now is fashion. Can you sell fashion? And the challenge is not for, so to speak, can you create a nice web experience that would sell fashion? Because clearly there are companies that are doing that. It's how would Amazon adjust that operating model? Because right now there's like 3,000 teams in there who are selling different products. So teams can start asking for their own UI.
Right.
Oh, okay. How would that work? That would be that's kind of an interesting organizational challenge.
Right. If the fashion people want to pioneer like a virtual reality, try things on, or even logistically, they want to, you know, that you know, they deliver it and then you have 5 hours to try it on, and then a car will come by and pick it up and take it if it doesn't fit. Like they might want to do that, but that's a whole new logistics offering for them.
Yes. Or it needs to be packed differently.
And And that's where like this notion of all four of these companies, Google, Facebook, Apple, and Amazon, the management is all about finding the products that really fit that they can make well. And of course, the risk is either that they pick something that they can't make well and they make it a really big bet, or they fail to be able to change that underlying platform when it really needs to change. And you know, one of the more brilliant things that Facebook and Google both did was move to mobile.
Yes.
You know, and that's a huge platform shift.
And they're now moving to machine learning. So in a sense, they're rebuilding from a consumer. And this is from a consumer point of view, almost don't notice it.
Right.
They rebuild all of their stuff around machine learning. And now you get like specific tangible things. Like now you can search inside photos or not. But very often it's just like, okay, you're now your Google search. You're the same Google search you did 5 years ago. It's just now suddenly it's 15% better because of machine learning.
Well, you
can't really see that. But
like Amazon, you know, it always used to be people who are interested in this also bought this. And most of that was sort of based on very straightforward query results of their purchase history.
Yeah.
But now they are going to have the technology using machine learning to start offering recommendations that are based on a lot deeper insight based on these learning techniques.
This was kind of the challenge of mobile, was it completely changed the operating environment. And so for Google and for Facebook, there was this real question, like actually our whole platform needs to be pointed on a completely different thing. And I think maybe there's like another strand here. Three of these four companies are still run by the founder. Each of them has seen the last 30 years of tech. And so they saw what happened to IBM. They saw what happened to Microsoft. They saw what happened to Yahoo and to AOL and to MySpace. And so they've sort of seen all of the lessons of what worked and what didn't work and what can happen to you. And they were all, you know, still super aggressive and quite young and like looking at that and are very determined to kind of take this platform and keep moving it.
I can't really overstate that kind of observation because that was one of the things that I thought was most fascinating very early on with not just the YouTube acquisition, but the integration strategy of YouTube. Because historically, in the software industry, acquisitions were done and then assimilated as quickly as possible. And I remember watching YouTube and going, when are they going to be able to sign on with a Gmail account? It took them 3 or 4 years before you could do that. And then you watch Facebook and you watch how that they've dealt with WhatsApp and Instagram, and they've kept them at this arm's length. And that's like a very clear lesson from how to deal with what we today know are disruptive technologies, a book that was just, you know, written in 1998, you know.
And I mean, you could argue that one of the problems with disruption is it doesn't work if everyone's read the book.
Right. On the other hand, what we're really saying is just like in the finance world, like there will be something, an event that happens. It's just that it won't be like they won't get disrupted by some technology paradigm shift. It'll be some other challenge that they face. Because I think that's something that you really need to internalize about these four companies is that they have built platforms, strategies, and organizations that understand how to deal with changes in technology in a way that past generation companies just had challenges with.
The lesson is how flexible these companies are at sort of pointing themselves at a different problem. It's not actually the specific product that you're holding in your hand or the chip or the, you know, the particular piece of software. It's the ability of that company to kind of pick itself up and point it somewhere else. I mean, we have this kind of the story from the past of, you know, the Bill Gates memo about the internet and kind of Microsoft picked it up and pointed itself at something else. And this is like this big case study of, oh my God, this is an amazing thing that happened. Like, how many times have Google and Facebook done that in the last 10 years?
Yeah.
In a sense, how many times even has Apple done that as they've maneuvered around, you know, obviously they have a longer product cycle. How many times has Amazon reoriented itself around different things? It's like actually a sort of structural change of these companies being able to react to change differently.
I remember early on in like 1995, you know, Jeff Bezos like doing books and telling people locally in Seattle, like at small dinners and stuff, like, well, we're definitely only doing books, because he had this very special understanding of book distributors and how they would, you know, not have warehouses. Like, we're not going to do warehouses, and we're definitely not going to do CDs and DVDs and movies. And then, you know, a year later, they're the largest DVD seller. They're starting to build giant warehouses. They're stocking the top 25 books. And he reinvented the company that he had. And that was a startup pivot. But then you think about how, like, we are never going to deliver groceries. And now here we are. What we tried to do with this podcast was just wrap up a conversation we've had about just how these big companies work. And we see lots of things that are pretty interesting from an org perspective and a lot of lessons for how founders should think about how they organize, adapt to change, and also work with these companies. So this has been Stephen Sanofsky,
Benedict Evans,
on the A16Z podcast.